When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Stacey Marie Ishmael is no stranger to covering white-collar crime. She's seen companies implode and executives go to prison. But even she found the speed with which FTX collapsed and Sam Bankman-Fried was arrested to be dizzying.
I think that looking at the timing from filing for bankruptcy, or even forget filing for bankruptcy, saying, alluding to the fact that they were potentially in distress, potentially having takeover conversations with Binance, to then filing for bankruptcy, and then in the space of about a month after that being, you know, taken under arrest, that does strike me as an unusually quick process.
Stacey Marie is the managing editor for crypto at Bloomberg News. And in a crazy crypto year, SBF's story is undeniably the most bananas.
I've often made the joke that a lot of what happens in crypto can feel like it's running at the rate of virality. That, you know, something is huge now or trending right now, and then, you know, 2 seconds later, nobody's talking about it, or vice versa. And as a result of that, the past 12 months has sometimes felt like speed running the financial crisis of 2008, where folks would start to have worries about a counterparty or think, I'm not even sure what is behind the assets of this particular thing, or like how highly rated those assets are. But that would take months, you know, like to work its way through the system. And in crypto, we're seeing it take not even days, in some cases, just hours.
In this case, it took just 9 days for FTX to go under. On November 2nd, a report by CoinDesk questioned the health of FTX's sister company, Alameda Research. By November 11th, FTX had filed for bankruptcy. And on Tuesday, the U.S. government unsealed charges against Sam Bankman-Fried.
This morning, we unsealed an 8-count indictment charging Samuel Bankman-Fried, FTX's founder, with a series of interrelated fraud schemes that contributed to FTX's collapse.
Today on the show, the case against SBF. He was once the face of crypto in the U.S. Now he's facing prison time. And the rest of the crypto industry is trying to make sense of the fallout. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If there was one baffling thing that stood out in the month since FTX declared bankruptcy, it was Sam Bankman-Fried's media tour. It was almost like he couldn't stop himself from talking to reporters.
Look, I should have been on top of this, and I feel really, really bad and regretful that I wasn't.
Apologizing again and again for what happened.
I didn't ever try to commit fraud on anyone. I was shocked by what happened this month. And, you know, reconstructing it, were there things I wish I had done differently? I was trying to do the best I could. Obviously, that wasn't nearly as good as I thought it was. I mean, look, I've had a bad month.
The government clearly isn't buying the story that, oops, he messed up. It was an accident. On Tuesday, they unveiled what are essentially three different kinds of charges. You can think of them as split into buckets, from the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
And so within those three buckets, there's one thing that's very consistent, and it's the idea that over the course of years, you know, supposedly starting as far back as at least 2019, Sam Bankman-Fried did a couple of things that none of these agencies find particularly appropriate. The first being allegedly commingling customer funds and you know, misusing customer funds for either his other businesses in the kind of the FTX Alameda empire or for personal use. That's one. The other is making mischaracterizations or misrepresentations of certain types of investments and securities. And then there's sort of a third, and I would say this is like a broader bucket that represents a lot of these things, which is really just about misleading people generally around what you were doing, how you were going to do those things. If you said A, did you do B instead? And you can get into like a lot of finessing as to like why each of these different agencies would all come out with different sets of charges. But I think one of the other things to note is, in addition to what they've laid out so far, various of the folks involved have made it clear that these might not be the only ones that we see.
Right. There are like some little notes within the various charging documents that say they've been talking to people, and I kind of love the lawyerly phrase here, of persons known and unknown. So like maybe there are some other shoes to drop here.
That's correct.
One of the things I find so striking, and you nodded to this, is that the Justice Department and the SEC say, you know, this goes back years, maybe back to FTX's founding. And that seems so strikingly at odds with the narrative that SBF has put forth in many, many media interviews, on Twitter, et cetera, which is sort of like, oops, things got out of control and I didn't notice. What do you make of that just sharp dissonance?
I mean, I think that's why this is probably going to take years to play out in court. It's the contrast between the public assertions, as you say, but also like the marketing, the Super Bowl advertising, the arena, the stadium rights, and what was actually allegedly going on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember, because this is the kind of thing you do for work, you know, reading the bankruptcy filing from the now CEO, former Enron liquidator, John J. Ray III, in which, you know, he had a series of blockbuster and extremely damning quotes about the quality of the information that he had access to. You know, he said this was like one of the most disorganized processes he'd ever encountered. He couldn't even get a complete list of people who were on the payroll.
That was something Ray highlighted in congressional hearings this week.
And he really continued with that message in his testimony on Tuesday, you know, saying, hey, look, I don't know what these folks were doing, but they were approving expenses on Slack and they were using QuickBooks for accounting and they were supposedly a multi-billion dollar business.
This one is unusual, and it's unusual in the sense that literally, you know, there's no record keeping whatsoever. It's the absence of record keeping. Employees would communicate, you know, invoicing and expenses on Slack, which is, you know, essentially a way of communicating for chat rooms. They use QuickBooks, a multi-billion dollar company using QuickBooks.
QuickBooks?
QuickBooks. Nothing against QuickBooks, very nice tool, just not for a multi-billion dollar company.
Right. The QuickBooks thing is really just kind of mind-blowing.
I mean, I don't know if you're supposed to laugh when you're covering bankruptcy, but it was a wild line. It was, you know, the idea of folks managing money or appearing to manage money for something that's kind of sold to media freelancers.
I can't stop thinking about, as I know many people can't, an interview with SBF on the Odd Lots podcast where he tries to explain yield farming, and your colleague Matt Levine sort of said, like, this sounds like a Ponzi scheme. And at the time, you know, those of us who think about this stuff thought, wow, like, that's great questioning by Matt. This is really interesting. And I have to admit, there was a part of me that thought, gee, maybe this is kind of over my head. And I keep coming back to that interview thinking, like, oh man, was this all a Ponzi scheme? Because in the space of the last month, my brain has traveled all over the place in trying to comprehend what exactly happened.
I think there are a lot of very highly paid people who are all trying to figure out what exactly happened right now. And, you know, the funny thing about the Odd Lots interview is there were actually two different, for me, equally compelling Odd Lots interviews. Mm. And in one of them, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried spent a lot of time talking about how sophisticated the risk engine was for FTX and Alameda, and how that meant they could do, like, real-time allocations to make sure that they weren't taking on excessive risk. That was also an episode in which he talked a lot about Tether, which is the largest stablecoin in crypto. And to me, the reason I mentioned that other episode is because part of what made him appealing and interesting to people appeared to be his grasp of the finer, more complex technical points of crypto. And, you know, lots of folks often in hindsight have argued, oh, I should have known, he didn't know what he was talking about. And the thing for me is, like, I'm not sure it's the case that he didn't know what he was talking about, right? I think it's that in a lot of cases, he may well have been saying things that he believed to be true. There were other cases, and my colleagues at Bloomberg have reported on this, where we would ask a direct question like, can you talk to us about how intermingled Alameda and FTX are? Because we have reporting that would suggest they're basically the same. And then he would say on the record, absolutely not. These are completely separate entities. You know, so I also don't buy the argument that he didn't know in all cases, because there were certainly times when on the record he would deny something to us that turned out later to be true. But I do think that this is a person who liked talking. I think this is a person who often was playing the role of, I'm a crypto CEO and I'm going to behave in certain types of ways, whether it's from the outfit choices that he would make, or, you know, the whole thing about appearing to shun like fanciness in general. I'm not going to comb my hair because I'm too focused on the work. And I think all of that was really part of a particular kind of narrative that worked until it stopped working.
It all stopped working, as we've noted, incredibly quickly. And the speed with which it unraveled does make me wonder, and I wanted to put this to you as someone who has covered white collar crime before, when something happens this fast, it makes me wonder, did someone flip on him?
I think one of the things, to go back to your point about, you know, persons known and unknown, that is striking is the complete absence of any other named co-defendants in any of the, you know, the three sets of charges that we've seen so far, either from the Department of Justice or the SEC or the CFTC, because no one person runs an empire made up of more than 100 different entities, which is the number of different FTX-related entities that filed for bankruptcy in November. And so you could extrapolate a couple of things. One, that cooperators exist. There are going to be people who are engaging in some kind of testimony or handing over of evidence, whether because they are compelled by subpoena to do so or because they think it's in their best interest. And two, again, as the various folks involved in these charges have made clear, because we haven't seen the end of this story yet.
There's also the question of political donations. SBF was a leading Democratic fundraiser, personally giving some $40 million in the last election cycle, mostly to Democrats and left-leaning causes. Though he's now said he also gave to Republicans, just without publicizing it.
The fact of the matter is, Bankman-Fried, along with other people who, again, have not been charged with anything, but who were also executives at FTX, donated very large sums of money to various politicians, to various political causes, as well as we know, to nonprofit organizations and media organizations. So, you know, there was a lot of money slushing around out there. And I think there's a big, open, scary question if you're a politician around, is some of that going to get clawed back?
Bankman-Fried was supposed to testify to Congress on Tuesday of this week. But by that time, he was in jail in the Bahamas. Instead, lawmakers got to hear from the man whose job it is to dispose of FTX's remains. When we talk about politics, we obviously have to talk about the hearings on Capitol Hill this week. And you alluded to some of the like perfectly tailored sound bites we heard from John Wray, who took over FTX to clean up this mess.
This is really old-fashioned in embezzlement. This is just taking money from customers and using it for your own purpose.
Really old-fashioned embezzlement is quite a statement. I wonder, you know, what those statements before Congress, like, what does that tell you about either the task in front of Wray or what law enforcement is able to look at and build their case with?
I mean, I think going in, the task in front of Wray was always going to be non-trivial. You don't lose $10 billion, whether because you mislabeled the accounts or something more nefarious, as has been alleged, and then bring somebody in and be like, hey, you know, shake out some couch cushions and $10 billion will appear. That was going to be a hard, hard set of tasks, no matter what. I do think that the perspective that Wray has is interesting. You know, again, he was the person who was brought in to try to find any salvageable assets in the aftermath of Enron,
yeah,
and get those assets out to people. So on the law enforcement question, that is a much more challenging one, not least because you're dealing with jurisdictions outside of the United States as well, right? So, you know, the reality of FTX is that FTX International specifically, is that it was domiciled not in the United States, but in the Bahamas. The Bahamas regulators have made it very clear that they don't think that the way that the U.S. appointed folks are handling this case is necessarily how the Bahamas would do it. So you've got like that jurisdictional spat shaping up. And then you have a series of other entities like FTX Japan, which is itself trying to make the argument that like, hey, those shenanigans over there, nothing to do with us. Please let us handle our creditors the way that we see fit. You know, a similar argument from FTX Europe. So I think that even if you were coming at this from the perspective of crypto companies by default are complicated, you layer all of this on top of it, and it is quite a challenge.
Well, that leads me to sort of two big questions that have been hanging out there for me, which is, when do you think we might have a sense of actually how much money we're talking about, how big this financial hole is? And then secondary to that, will customers ever get their money back?
I think on both of those fronts, it was striking to consider what John J. Wray said in that hearing on Tuesday, which was basically, don't keep your hopes up.
Look, at the end of the day, we're not going to be able to recover all the losses here, right? Money was spent that we'll never get back. There will be losses on the international side. We're hopeful on the U.S. side. He'll answer to others related to what happened here. Our job is just to, you know, find the assets and try to get customers their money back as quickly as possible.
And if you're an FTX customer, that is a really demoralizing position to be in. You know, he said it seems likely that folks in the U.S. have a better chance of getting some of their money back. Maybe the situation seems to be worse for customers outside who, you know, did not have accounts with FTX US. I think one of the things that he did fairly effectively is paint a picture of chaos, right? It's not that there was a hidey hole that, you know, someone shoved in a corner and it was like, don't look here because that's where all the money is. It's more like it's been really hard for him and the other folks tasked with unraveling the situation to even identify where to start.
And I believe, just for context here, that people are still trying to get their money back from the Mt. Gox collapse, which was what, 2014?
Right, exactly. And, you know, Mt. Gox is, I think, a useful comparison because it was, for a lot of people, the first really large collapse of a crypto exchange. Circumstances were very different, but there are really thorny questions around, okay, you're going to get your money back. Does that mean you're going to get back what your Bitcoin would have been worth in 2014, which is not a lot of money, or what it's worth now, which is potentially significantly more because of some of the price appreciations? Would it have been the value at the time that you put it in or the time that you would have been able to withdraw it? You know, and that's just a pure up and down valuation question. And that's only one of thousands of kinds of questions that are facing the folks who are dealing with what happened to FTX.
When we come back, should we worry about this whole thing spreading? Or is the fire around FTX contained?
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
After FTX collapsed and Sam Bankman-Fried was arrested, other exchanges were at pains to reassure their customers that they were solvent. Just this week, the exchange Binance released a report intended to show that it had reserves on hand. But it was not the kind of audited statement you might see from a regulated bank. When you look at all of the drama surrounding FTX, but also kind of the larger crypto ecosystem in the past several weeks, I wonder where you think this leaves the other big centralized exchanges.
So FTX was not the largest by any means of the crypto exchanges. it was decently sized, but the largest by far is a crypto exchange called Binance. And Binance, which we mentioned earlier, because they were the ones who for a second looked like might buy FTX when it became clear that FTX was in distress. So you have Binance, which is, you know, the biggest of them all, and that's been true for a long time. In the US, there's only one publicly traded crypto exchange, and that's Coinbase, who also known for Super Bowl advertising.
Yep.
Still significantly smaller than Binance in terms of both like number of customers, but also volumes. And folks have had a lot of questions over the past, I would say, 6 months. So like long before the FTX bankruptcy, which is, how is everyone doing? Because over the past 6 months, you've had, you know, a series of crypto crises, a general decline in market prices, a waning of sentiment that has weighed on things that were popular, like non-fungible tokens or NFTs. And so folks were like, you know, just as businesses, how are these folks going? And one of the things that has happened over the past several months is, you know, Coinbase, as well as some other exchanges like with names like Kraken, have had to lay off a lot of their employees. So in a sense, they were buffeted by the same kind of macroeconomic forces that have led other tech companies to lay off their employees. Folks have been asking, you know, are these people well capitalized? If something else were to go really, really wrong, are they going to be all right? And that has led to a lot of calls for increased transparency. How do we know that you have the money that you say you have? How do we know that you have the crypto that you say you have?
Right, because unlike banks, these guys do not have to keep, you know, tier one capital reserves, et cetera.
Exactly. There is no, you know...
There's no Dodd-Frank here.
Love a Dodd-Frank reference. No, there's no Dodd-Frank. There's nobody like shaking a big stick marked auditor at them. Except for Coinbase, which again is a publicly traded financial institution and therefore does have a higher bar for the regulations that apply to it, but it's not regulated like a bank because it's not a bank. And, you know, so I think the questions facing Binance and Coinbase and Kraken and all these other folks are ones they have really tried to tackle head on. And, you know, so there's been an outbreak of reassuring memos and blog posts and tweets being like, this is how we're fine. This is how you know we're fine. No, really, we're totally fine. Which, of course, sometimes has the effect of making people more worried. So it's a bit of a vicious cycle.
The speed of the stories coming out about the crypto industry is pretty intense. I mean, just to cite kind of a fascinating one to me, the New York Times ran a piece that the executives of the big exchanges were all in like a Signal group chat together, which has this thing of like, oh my God, these things are worth billions of dollars. And yet these guys are all texting. It maybe lends to the idea that this is an impenetrable world that people just don't understand.
So first of all, kudos to the New York Times. That was a good scoop. And I'm annoyed by how good it was because I would have really liked the whole story. But I think I have two observations here.
Yeah.
One is most CEOs are in touch with their peers. Hmm. You know, media CEOs are like hanging out in Sun Valley or wherever it is that they go to, or having dinner parties, or playing golf. Again, like I'm clearly not a media CEO, but I imagine that golf is a thing that some of them would do. So I don't think it's that unusual that you have folks using the technologies that they're most comfortable with, and like Signal, Telegram, these are like very crypto-y type chat platforms. Like media CEOs would have probably had like an assistant contact another assistant and book a dinner or something. What I do think was revelatory about the content of the message in the Times was the, again, that sort of thin-skinned competitiveness, where it was like, dude, why are you trying to screw the rest of us over? Was
right. Don't tweet about my exchange. You're hurting us.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. It was the sort of very sharp, you know, sharp-elbowed tenor to that conversation that, again, felt very, very personal, right? Mm-hmm. It felt to me that this wasn't just people who were competing with each other. You got the impression that they actively didn't really like each other as well.
So Binance's CEO, Changpeng Zhao, CZ, to most people who follow this stuff, mentioned turbulent times ahead. And you all at Bloomberg recently had a podcast about how crypto investors are feeling right now. And I guess I wonder, like, are people spooked? What's the vibe?
Depends on who you ask is always the answer to that question in crypto. The Bitcoin true believers have recently adopted a refrain of one Bitcoin is one Bitcoin. And what they mean by that is, you know, ignore all the noise. If you believe that Bitcoin is the future, however many Bitcoin you had last September is, you know, those are still Bitcoin. They might be worth a lot less if you convert them into fiat. But converting them into fiat is not the point. The point is that you believe in the Bitcoin ecosystem. That's one approach. Another approach is the people who are like, this is really boring. I can't make any money here anymore. you know, because there was a fair amount of activity in the market that was really speculation and arbitrage. And you could still make money in a declining market, for sure. There are all kinds of trades that you could do. It's actually a lot harder to make money when there's not a lot of stuff happening, right? When you have prices being what, you know, my fellow folks in finance and business media like to call range bound.
What does that mean in English?
Range bound is like, you know, if the price of Bitcoin is either at $17,000 or $16,500, you don't have a lot of opportunity to make a bunch of money if the only fluctuation is $500 at a time. Hmm. You have the opportunity to make a bunch of money if it's pinging back and forth between, say, $12,500 and $20,000. Like, there's a lot more stuff that you can do. And so the idea of range bound is essentially, this is too chill for me to be able to profit on this. But then, you know, I think much more importantly than either of those two constituencies are the people who really got hurt. They are the people who had their life savings in Celsius, or who had, you know, assets tied up on FTX US or in Voyager, or who had invested in crypto because a celebrity told them that this was a good idea, or they bought a Bored Ape because it looked to them like these prices could only ever go up. A lot of people have lost a lot of money. Some of the people who've lost a lot of money can afford to lose a lot of money, but I don't think that's true for everybody.
You know, another constituency here, and we talked a bit about the congressional hearings, but a constituency here overall is Congress. And Congress has been very slow to figure out how, if at all, they would like to deal with crypto. But something that is high profile and blows up, and then potentially something where you might have a constituent who loses money, that tends to get their attention. I wonder what you think the temperature is in Washington right now for conversations about regulating crypto.
Tense. that is the vibe that I'm certainly getting from my colleagues who cover the Hill very closely and who are there every single day. But I also wouldn't say that it's necessarily straightforward. And that's something you would have certainly gotten a flavor of from, you know, the hearings on Tuesday and then additional hearings on Wednesday, which is crypto still has a lot of fans in DC. There are still lawmakers, there are still legislators who think that there's a tremendous amount of potential financial innovation that can be unlocked using the blockchain. There are still folks who think that, you know, crypto is a good way to on-ramp people into financial inclusion who may be underbanked or unbanked. And then there are people on the other end who are like, this is the worst thing that anyone has ever invented. I'm disappointed that you're even talking to me about this because it's terrible and it's a scam and everything's bad.
People like California Democrat Brad Sherman, who in the hearing touted that he was the only lawmaker to get an F from the only crypto organization that rates members of Congress.
My fear is that we'll view Sam Bankman-Fried as just one big snake in a crypto Garden of Eden. The fact is, crypto is a garden of snakes.
And then there are folks in between. So I don't think that, you know, consensus has shifted entirely in one direction or another. But I do think that some folks who may have been particularly gung-ho might be a little bit more tempered now. And folks who were already sure that crypto was the worst thing ever have doubled down on that belief.
Maybe there is no way to answer this question right now, but I just keep wondering. And admittedly, I have wondered throughout the various crypto meltdowns that we have seen over the past 6 months, but I've wondered if this is an inflection point. And if it is, how big an inflection point it is for crypto?
I mean, the thing with that question is crypto is constantly facing inflection points. You know, if we look at when, to go back to Coinbase, the only publicly traded exchange in the United States, them going public was a huge moment for folks who believed that crypto's time had finally come. Like, here was the most mainstream financy thing you could possibly do, which was sell shares to the general public. And this crypto company had achieved that. Then you had the potential inflection point of, you know, in the US at least, it was finally possible to buy ETFs backed by Bitcoin futures.
Exchange-traded funds for non-finance people.
For a certain proportion of people who their compliance department say would not let them hold Bitcoin directly, that was a really attractive solution, right? So if you're like a pension fund, for example, with billions of dollars in capital to put to work, and you really wanted to put some of that to work in crypto, you would not necessarily be able to convince anybody that buying Bitcoin directly was a good idea, but you could buy a Bitcoin-backed futures exchange-traded fund and you wouldn't get into too much trouble, probably. You then had a series of negative inflection points. You had the collapse of the Terra USD algorithmic stablecoin and the associated token Luna, which precipitated the collapse of a formerly well-respected hedge fund called Three Arrows Capital.
And I would say that took a lot of collateral damage along with it.
Collateral damage is a good way of putting it, indeed. So, you know, I'm thinking about this in terms of like the ups and downs of a Bitcoin price chart, overlaying it on top or overlaying these news events on top of it. What has been surprising to a lot of observers is actually the resilience of crypto prices despite these extremely negative headline events. There were predictions from folks that, you know, oh, whoa, Bitcoin is going to go to $8,000 by the end of the year. It hit $18,000 this week. It's not at $65,000 or anywhere close to where it was trading last year and earlier in this year, but it still hasn't careened off of a cliff in the way that some of the more skeptical folks would have predicted it would have.
So you're a little more sanguine.
I think that's my job. I think my job as a reporter and an editor is to observe, ask questions, hopefully sufficiently challenging questions, and then, you know, say like, hey, this is what's happening and this is our best understanding of why these things are happening and the dynamics that are driving it. You know, the phrase that we use a lot is, it's our job to be rigorously skeptical. It's not our job to be nihilistic, and it's not our job to be PR. Our job is in between. It's like, what's actually happening and how can we help people understand what's actually happening?
Stacey Marie Ishmael, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stacey Marie Ishmael is the managing editor of crypto for Bloomberg. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. Our show is edited by Jonathan Fisher. Joanne Levine is the executive producer for What Next. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and we're also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And if you're a fan of the show, I have a little request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. You can just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. You get all your Slate podcasts without ads, and it makes a lovely holiday gift. All right, we will be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotarucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.